Let's turn, please, to Luke chapter 14. 15, I'm sorry, Luke chapter 15. Luke 15. Remember now that in Luke 15, everything is an answer to how, in contrast to the Pharisees who avoid sinners, the Father's attitude is one of seeking them out, receiving them, and welcoming them, as does Jesus. And we said this morning that if you go to verse 2, the Pharisees and the scribes began grumbling, saying, quote, as we read their quote, the whole 15th chapter is an answer to that remark. This man receives sinners and eats with them. And the answer is going to be the seeking parables. And we said seeking parables, according to verse 3, we should treat them as one, because he told them this parable, singular. And then we have three stories. And we've looked at the first one with the lost sheep. And now we're ready to look at the parable of the seeking woman. They all have the same motif, seeking. They all have the same pattern, and that pattern is always loss, search, recovery, and joy. And along the line of the last one, the joy is not just personal. It's always a banquet. It's always bringing in all of our friends. We found the lost sheep. Let's have a party. And everybody celebrates. And in all of these, there is that type of thing. And that motif goes through all of the parables and is identical in each one, as we'll see when we come to the summary of this next week. The parable of the woman begins with a scene. And the scene before was simply very general. We had the scene preceding that of being in a Pharisee's home for a very festive Sabbath meal, but now the scene is in a peasant home. And I take it the change in scenery in each one of these is designed to get the lesson of seeking across to a maximum amount of people. He gets it across to the listening multitudes. He gets it across to the Pharisees and the self-righteous that are criticizing. And now he moves into a very simple Palestinian home, and he is going to point out another parable of seeking. The home would be something like this. The floor would be dirt. The dirt floor was maintained, or two problems obviously came with a dirt floor. One was dampness, and the other would be dust under dry condition. So the floor was dirt with straw on top. And the straw was not really just a thin layer, it was fairly thick. The reason for that is you wanted to absorb dampness, you wanted to prevent the cold, and you wanted it so when someone slid or scuffed their foot on the floor, that it didn't open up a bare place. So you had a pretty good layer of straw on the top, and therefore, in that type of thing, a small object, loss was easy. Second, and let's read the parable. What woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, carefully search until she finds it? Now, in this context, there are three possibilities of the coin or the lost coin. Three ways it could have been lost. Because there were three ways that she could have carried the coin. One of them could have simply been either a coin that was left in a small rag, wrapped in a small rag. And they carried coins in that way. Or it could have been part of a dowry. If it was part of a dowry, a bride kept the coins of the dowry on her forehead. And therefore they would simply be attached with a band, or they could be attached by some type of adhesive directly to her forehead. And that was the place that the bride's dowry was given, mounted on the forehead. And therefore, if it was this, you would have not only monetary, but added to it, you would have emotional attachment. To lose that would suggest that you didn't take care of your husband's possessions well. So loss on the part of a woman would suggest unfaithfulness. I don't mean moral or sexual unfaithfulness. I simply mean that what was given to her was a trust, and she was to take care of it for her husband, and consequently to lose it would be a disgrace. Now, the search for the coin would involve several things. Number one, you got to sift the straw. So the first process will be to take the straw, sift through it. Once you've sifted through it, then you would begin in a corner and sweep toward the center of the room to find the lost coin. And thus the words of the text, verse 9, she does that. Verse 8, she has 10 coins, loses one. The home usually was not lit well either, so she lights a lamp, sweeps the house, that would be taking off the straw covering, and then she searches carefully until she finds it. When she finds it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin which I had lost." Spiritual application in the same way. I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So we've now had two parables on which everybody would agree. If a woman loses a coin, does she go after it? Yes, she does. If a man loses a sheep, does he go after it? Yes, he does. And they would all agree. And this is leading toward the climactic parable. And the climactic parable is the seeking father, or we will stick with what it is typically called, and that is the parable of the prodigal son. The parable of the prodigal son. And notice it's much larger. It takes in 15:11 through 32. And a few words of introduction to this well-known parable. First of all, to call it the parable of the prodigal son is misleading. The emphasis is not on the son, but the emphasis is on the seeking father. That's the stress. Not on the son, but on the seeking father. Now, granted, there's plenty of time devoted to, and we will not really get to tonight, the seeking father part of it, but that is going to be the stress. The evidence for that is the seeking father is mentioned 12 times. The parable accomplishes two things. Number one, the parable condemns the Pharisees. Or it condemns the religion of the Pharisees, whose theology we explained this morning. God hates sinners and God loves the righteous. By definition, of course, we who perform properly are the righteous, and therefore we should identify with God in His attitude in that we love righteous people like us, religious people like us, and we hate sinners. Therefore, we do not associate with them. We do not socialize with them. They are outcasts. They're on the outside. However, Jesus did. And that's our beef with Jesus. And that's why we cannot satisfy ourselves that He is deity. And Jesus is going to come back with these parables, and especially this third one, and He's going to condemn the attitude of the Pharisees. The second thing that this parable accomplishes is it does reveal very clearly the love of the Father for sinners. So you have a dual emphasis, a dual purpose that is accomplished by it. Let me give you a little bit of the content outline. So we'll see what it's about, then we can go into some detail. Content outline. Part one is His departure. And the departure from home is described in 15:11 through 13a. And we'll find out that Jesus takes a very common illustration, and we will be able to find out that the illustration of the departing son is no different than the attitude that occurs among departing children today. And the ideas are involved, we'll detail, but let's look just at the text first. And notice that 11 through 13a, emphasis on departure. Verse 11. A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me." And he divided his wealth between them. And not many days later, the young son gathered everything together, went on a journey into a distant country. And when we come to it, as soon as we complete the content outline, we will do some analysis of his thinking. And I'm sure either some of you have been through this because you did it once, or you have children that you can be sure are probably going to do it. But his departure is emphasized in 15:11 through 13a. The second thing is a picture of his life abroad. 15:13b through 19. And it will focus on, number one, his dissipation. He goes out, he lives his own life, he dissipates, and that is 15 and verse 13b. Notice the way it reads, verse 13, the B part. Starting with the last line, the word and there he squandered his estate with loose living. Yeah, probably that too. With loose living. And it describes his dissipation. The word that is translated squandered is the normal Greek word for sowing seed. And it's the picture of simply taking a handful and throwing it like this. And so he takes his whole life and his activities, and he just goes out and dissipates. He throws everything in every direction that's there. That dissipation is followed by his discipline. With verse 14. When he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in the country, and he began to be in need. And he went and attached himself to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed the swine. Discipline now is 14 through 16. Wow, can you imagine a good Jewish boy feeding pigs? Severe discipline. Now, verse 15, he went and attached himself to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he was longing to fill his stomach with pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. That is followed then as he reaches the end of the line to he comes to his senses and he makes a decision. And the decision is 15:17 through 19. The child who runs away and decides I'm going to live my own life is not hopeless. Because as apart from the parents as this child was, he is allowed to feel the realities of life. We read in verse 17, he came to his senses. Or as if you see the margin, literally the word senses, he came to himself. And suddenly all of the wild, crazy ideas that caused him to leave home, and we'll examine those ideas, that caused him to leave home, all of a sudden in the real world collapse. And when he came to his senses, he said, and we will find next then as part three, his return. And his return is in 15:20 through 32. And on his return, we will focus on the reception by his father, accompanied by the rejection by his brother. So that then, in essence, of what we're going to be going through. And now let's turn to part one, departure from home. And we'll simply note some things underneath it. And the first will be, why, in his thinking, did he want so badly to leave home? So our first point then will be the logic of the departing son. Now when I say logic, I don't mean it's logical as in right. But it was logic to him. And his mental state reasoned out things in the following way. Number one, he obviously was tired of home. Tired of staying home. Obviously, he would not have departed had he been happy about being there. Why would a youngster be tired of staying home? Probably parental restraint. As you know, and maybe you went through this once, the great threat to the success of many young people in their mind is the old man and the old lady want me to get in at a certain time. They have rules around this place, and those rules restrict me, they limit me, they do not give me full expression of who I truly am as a person, and therefore, of course, and I'm sure he did like the rest, all of the peers, fellow peers, would say the same thing. It is true. You need to break loose of the restraints. It is tough around here. And it is too bad that you can't give true expression to the real you because mom and dad stand in the way. So this kid was obviously tired of staying home. Coming out of that was obviously a belief. And the belief was this. He believed happiness could be derived from independence. Happiness could be derived from independence. Are we going through anything here that you're not familiar with? Or didn't once think. Now keep in mind, certain of this is normal. I would question a 15 or 16 year old that didn't begin to want to feel out independence. I did. And the more I was challenged with you can't, the more I was determined to what? To do. And my parents made the I was a ripe age of 16, said, "You can certainly date, but we're not going to tolerate you settling down with one person and going steady." What did I do at age 17? Spent my whole summer wages plus my fraternity jacket and bought a diamond ring, because I could think for myself. I knew what I was doing. Still angers me. I haven't had the guts to go back and get the either one of them. But nonetheless, there's the belief that if I can be independent, then I will truly blossom and be a happy person. And this is part of the thinking. We could put it another way. Freedom to do what I want will bring me a life of pleasure. Third, and this is so typical, he had, and we'll see this very heavily throughout here, he had the "I want it now" mentality. He had the "I want it now" underscore now mentality. And at an early age, all you're really concerned about is now. Isn't that true? I don't think many 15 or 16 years old read the obits. But an age comes when you kind of look at that page and, ooh, he died at 58 or 60 or 65. And you begin to say, well, ooh, that's close. But that's not typical of a teenager, is it? You don't think about, you think about the now. And this is very much part of his mentality. That is his logic. Now, he had a problem. And you know what the problem is going to be. We mentioned it this morning. I want to be free so I can do what I want and I will be happy. But there's a great big problem with that. And it is spelled, as you well know, M-O-N-E-Y. How am I going to finance my freedom? Often, that can be one of the first great lessons of life. Yes, you may do anything you want, but we won't finance it. And that can bring you right up against the wall of saying, facing a reality in life. The major thing about teenage years, and it's where parents need to help, is taking the teenager and helping them to be real about life. That's always the difficulty. We're idealistic. We have talents. We have desires. We want to do these things. But it takes a little time to learn to be realistic about what life really is. And that's why many times to rescue a young person is not the best thing in the world, because they were just on the verge of learning a great lesson. You know, they got caught on Friday night and they're in jail and they've explained what happened. They were taking a walk and lo and behold was these bushes over there, and they happened to look under the bush and lo and behold someone had left a six pack there. And we picked it off the bush, you know, and end up in jail. Now you're just on the verge of learning something really important in life. And I would probably do it too, though I never had to. I would probably be down as soon as I got the call with what? My billfold, and say, oh, I can't stand to see him stare all night. Here's the money, let him out. And I've just, you know, meant well, but I've just allowed him to postpone. After all, it wasn't so bad. We were only in the can for 30 minutes. Mom and Dad came down, they got me out. They gave me cold milk and chocolate chip cookies to make me feel good when I got home, and might have even gone far enough to make it a rather pleasant experience that, you know, hey, I think I'll try this again. I got some things I ordinarily didn't get. But it's easy, and it's understandable how parents can easily stand in the way of some of the realism of life. I think it's interesting that this father did not stand in the way. I'm not advocating that what he did was necessarily right, but it is interesting that he is going to say, you want money to go out there and spend any way you want? Here it is, baby, go. And he takes off and he goes out there. And apparently the father is wise enough to know that all of these things come to an end, and they have now, keep in mind, this is a parable. I'm not implying that this is what the Word teaches to do. I'm just making observations here. So the problem becomes money to finance the venture. So the problem then is followed with his proposal. And notice the proposal in verse 12. The younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me." Remember what we said? What kind of mentality does he have, which is typical? I want it now. Ordinarily, when would he get his share? Under Old Testament law. He had a brother. So under ordinary circumstances, in the law of Moses, he would have received one-third, two-thirds to the brother, firstborn, one-third at his father's death. But you see, that he couldn't buy that, because that is not now. Furthermore, my dad's healthy, probably, and he figured that I just don't want to wait. So notice the "I want it now" type of mentality. Now, in verse 12, when he asked his father to share the estate, we ought to add one other thing. By the law, he would get it at death. Could he give it to him early? And the answer to that is yes. By the law, he did not have to, and I'm sure the law was wise in saying wait till death, but he could do that. And we'll find out in the context he did. Now, one other thing. A father, before his death, could and often did give gifts of property before death. And the reasoning there would be, a father might say, "I would like to see my children enjoying some of this money right now while I'm alive to observe them spend it." And that is a nice attitude. It's recorded in Genesis 25:6. Genesis 25:6. Verse 5, Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living, and sent them away to his own Isaac eastward. So notice, you do have a precedent who Abraham chose, and he said, "I'd like to give some of my children something now." That was done. What the son required, however, was one-fourth. So that in the latter part of verse 12, it says he divided his wealth among them. Now stop and think of how difficult that was going to be. Number one, he would have to break up the estate. So the estate was broken. And notice, it was also converted to cash. State was broken, and part, or one-third, converted to cash. That would have to be, because the son spends all of his inheritance in a distant land. So it couldn't be simply saying, "Okay, one-third of the estate, the property, the real estate is yours." It would have to be broken down, broken into parts, converted to cash, and given to the son, which the father does. With that, we move then to life abroad. Departure, and now life abroad. And that is in 15:13. And following. And as he lives abroad, down through verse 16, he will learn two things. Number one, he will learn that he traded, and he will admit all of this, he traded freedom for fetters. And that will become very vivid the way he does that. And second, we'll find that he traded, or he will learn that, he traded freedom for humiliation. But first, freedom for fetters. And this young man will learn then three things. And we'll point this out from the text. Number one, he learned the peril. And there are going to be three of these. He will learn, number one, the peril of now planning. Emphasis on the word planning. And that will follow by two others. He will learn the parable of now type of planning, now type of living, and then eventually the now type of spending. And all those lessons will come home as he leaves home and he faces the reality of what life really is. First of all, the peril of now planning. Verse 13. Only a person with now mentality would do this. Okay, let's suppose the estate amounted to $20,000. And you're about to depart home and to go out into the unknown. What would a wise person do? Take it all or make a backup? Leave a little bit at home. Go ahead and take 15. But leave 5,000 at home, because after all, doesn't good sense say you don't know what's going to happen out there? Is that the way a now thinker does? No, not a now thinker. I know I'll find happiness out there, and I know I can finance it with my $20,000, so I will take all of it, sir, and I will take all of it with me. And therefore, notice coming down to verse 13, not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together. Do you have in some translations all that he had? That's a good one. That's a good way to do it. Is that what, NIV? NIV says, he took with him all that he had. And that is the meaning of the Greek text. Everything. He took every nickel he got and goes on a journey. So the peril of now thinking is, because of that now planning, he took it all. He did not ask. He would not ask because he was a now planner. He did not ask, what happens if this doesn't work out? Didn't ask this. It's just assumption that it will. But he never asks, what happens if this does not work? As it's often been said, a fool always invests everything in his pipe dream. And this man has a pipe dream. And he will put everything he's got into that because he is so sure that he can make it okay. And that is the parable of the now planning. We might add something to that. If he had done a simple thing, he would have never made this mistake. What do you think it might have been that would have made him ask this question? What if it doesn't work out? What if it doesn't work out is simply the kind of mentality that says, I know what I see now, but what's down here? What about the end? What about the consequences that may come as a result of this action? Now thinkers don't do that. And consequently, he gave no thought of the end. How could he have been saved from that? How do we, at any age, get saved from all of our foolishness? What is our salvation from foolishness? Isn't it the Word of God? You say, well, did this guy have any teaching on that? Sure he did. The book of Proverbs has got a whole heap of afterwards teaching. Let's turn to the first one. Proverbs chapter 5. In the literature of his own people, the Jewish people, there was a strain of rich teaching in the book of Proverbs about people who never think of consequences. I went to a school, first year of college when I was 17. And I remember an old Southern preacher, didn't have lots of education, but he was wise. And at chapel, almost every day, and he didn't say it, he screamed it. Young people, don't sacrifice the permanent on the altar of the immediate. And he screamed that at us because he says, that's exactly what many of you will do. By the way, as a parenthesis, that was 1957, and the school had existed at least 15 years before that, and he was able to stand up on the platform and say this, of the 3,000 students for over 15 years, we have never sent one girl home to mom and dad pregnant. Can you identify with such insanity? Well, we knew as students that the old man was tough. And he says, you abide by the rules, or you pack your dirty duds and get out of here. And we knew it. And it is interesting to see nice results like that. I wonder how many schools. Can you imagine the chancellor of MU saying, over our 50-year history, we've never sent a girl home pregnant. You know? And that was part of the standard of, it was drilled into you. Don't sacrifice the permanent on the altar of the immediate. And the same teaching comes through in Proverbs, chapter 5 and verse 4. Now, the subject here is warning young men, about strange women. And we're not going to detail that. But 5:4 comes in for the first time in the book of Proverbs, an expression. It is, but in the end, and some translations translate it afterward, but what it's doing is saying, what you do now is going to have consequences down the road. And notice the whole string of teaching. Verse 3, the lips of the adulteress drip honey. How pleasant in the now. And smoother than oil is her speech. How present is the now. But in the end, she's bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. And that was part of the Jewish literature that this young man had access to, but of course, we're smarter than the sages. And of course, it apparently, if was known, was not heeded. Take it on a little bit further. Chapter 14, verse 12. There is a way which seems right to man, but the afterwards is death. And it's a warning against living life by human viewpoint. And then in verse 13, even in laughter, the heart may be in pain, and the end of joy, or the afterwards of joy, may be grief. And I couldn't help but think of this proverb. This was again Friday night after we'd eaten. The man had a... apparently it's on, I don't know whether on cable or where they picture disasters. Does anyone identify with that? Maybe that's just in the Lincoln area. But they give you a documentary of various disasters that have happened in the United States. And this person had a documentary of the Hyatt. And he said, would you like to see it? And I said, yes. And in watching it, I couldn't help but think, having been there that evening, everyone was having such a wonderful time. But there was an afterwards, and the afterwards was grief. And that's what this proverb is talking about. It means you got to pull out of the now and look to the future. Chapter 16, verse 25. Same thing. There's a way which seems right to man, but the end thereof is the way of death. And the exhortation is, be sure that you think of doing it God's way. Because if you don't, the path at the end of doing it your way is death. Then chapter 20.
look at verse 21 and see if you think it's appropriate to the prodigal son. Remember, he asked for his inheritance now, and he got it now. Should he have known better? Boy, doesn't this verse just absolutely classic commentary on that, isn't it? Chapter 20, verse 21. An inheritance gained hurriedly at the beginning will not be blessed in the end. And had the young man known that and believed it, he wouldn't have had to go out there and suffer what he had to suffer to eventually come around. That's also mentioned in 24, 20, 25, and verse 8. So he learned the parable of now planting. Number two, he learned the parable of now living. Now, each time we use the word now, keep it in a quote marks because we'll miss the meaning if we don't. Parable of the now style of living. And that's Luke 15:13b. Last part of verse 13, last line. And there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now when he spent everything. So notice the peril of now living is very simple principle, and it's this. No one has enough money to buy everything that his sin nature wants. No one has enough money to satisfy his sin nature or his sinful proclivities. Why can't that be? Well, there's a word that defines one of the characteristics of all of our natures. It's the Greek word pleonexia, translated covetousness, which means desire for more. The sin nature is just like a rubber bag. You fill it and it stretches. You fill it more and it stretches. And it stretches and it stretches and it stretches and it stretches and is never satisfied. There's no way that the sin nature can suffer satiety simply because it stretches to meet the need. And this young man learns that he spent everything. He squandered his estate, and that is the peril of that kind of living. Probably a good translation in English for the word squandered would be dissipated everything. That's the peril of now living, which he learned. He also, third, learned the peril of now spending. Verse 14. Now, what is there about now spending that's dangerous? Now spending says we have an adequate amount now, therefore let's spend it now. And it never takes into, it assumes present circumstances will always be the same. Now spending assumes present conditions will be future conditions. And I give an easy concrete example of that because you see people doing it all the time. They're at work and their now mentality says, I want that red sports car. Do you have a job? Yes. But the plant is laying off people at the rate of 5 a week. And so you buy the car. What is that assuming? It will not get me. I will not get laid off. And it assumes that the present conditions are going to be the future conditions. And so he spends. And thus in verse 14, he didn't plan for a famine to hit his playground. But a famine hits his playground. And thus verse 14, now when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and it began to be in need. So notice the assumption that everything would be the same was wrong thinking, and things began at this point to fall apart. He went and attached himself to one of his citizens of the country and sent him into fields to feed his swine. And he was longing to fill his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. Boy, there's a big lesson in life. They would take his money to give him pleasure, but when he was out of money, what was he to them? They wouldn't keep him alive with food. All right, second major point here. We've had number one, he traded the freedom for the fetters. And number two, he traded freedom for humiliation. Freedom for humiliation. And the humiliation was two things. One, forced service. That's verse 15. And fruitless service. Verse 16. And when you find out that nobody would give him any food, you want to wonder, where were his friends that probably patted him on the back and said, yeah, you really need to leave home. You'll really blossom when you leave home. Where were they? It's inevitable, and how many teens may hear this, but your friends probably mean very well. But keep in mind, the very friend that would encourage you to rebel probably will not be there. Well, I know they promised they would, didn't they? But after all, if they're rebellious themselves, they won't have any food either. So you can all get together in your poverty and moan and groan and talk about how we were abused and misused. One of the interesting things about this young man in the particular context is that he learned, and we'll cover them Wednesday, he learned four big lessons in life. And when you're in trouble, what is the first lesson about life that you must learn? I am responsible for my condition. And as long as that is played with, there can be no road back. And so notice in, and we'll pick up with this next time, but notice coming down to verse 17. When he came to his senses. How did he come to his senses? He hit life straight in the face. And he came to his senses when he crashed. He came to his senses when he had nothing to eat. He came to his senses when his stupid thinking about freedom, his fun, his happiness, all burst. And fortunately it did, and in its contents. He begins with number one, when he came to his senses. And when he came to his senses, he begins to say, well, there are four things here, but we don't have time for them now. We'll do them Wednesday. One of the things about coming to his senses, he doesn't sit down and say, I made an unwise decision. He doesn't say, I was a bit foolish. He doesn't say, I didn't plan well. He gets down to the guts of it. What are the guts of it? Verse 18. I will get up, go to my father, and say to him, Father, I made a strategic error. I sinned. And that will be one of the other things that he learns, to call real things by their real names. And we will find out those four things and look at them when we come up in our next study of the prodigal son. Father, tonight we're thankful for this story. We're thankful that it is based in reality. And we would pray always for each family within Beth Haven Church. May we recognize that all of us who have children are responsible for discipline, responsible for good advice. Grant that we not be overtaken with sentimentality and confuse sentimentality with true love that is always tough. And grant us the wisdom to allow our children to learn the real lessons of life. Grant us the wisdom to bring to them things such as are found in Proverbs that at least will be there in their mentality when the time comes, and the information and the truth will be available to them. And therefore, Father, we pray that as we continue in this parable, we will understand the kind of a heart that opens up to this young man and kills the fatted calf when he gets his head together and gets life straightened out. And we pray we will continue to learn from this in Christ's name. Amen.